Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last Monday, on the same day the Trump administration welcomed 49 white South Africans to the United States, they got rid of deportation protections for over 9,000 Afghan refugees. Newsweek reports that the group of South Africans arrived on a plane chartered by the Trump administration, and they were fast-tracked through the normal refugee resettlement process that typically takes months or longer. The group claimed they were fleeing racial and violent persecution and widespread seizures of white-owned land, despite evidence that such claims are untrue, according to the AP. Trump has also made debunked claims that white farmers in South Africa are being killed in a genocide. So what are the actual facts? Well, the AP reports that violent crime is rife in South Africa. But experts say the vast majority of victims are Black and poor. Police statistics show that up to 75 people in South Africa are killed daily across the country. This comes as the Trump administration terminated temporary protected status granted by the Biden administration for over 9,000 Afghans. And then yesterday, the Supreme Court allowed the administration to end temporary protected status for over 350,000 Venezuelans. As we know, Trump has promised to carry out what his administration calls the largest domestic deportation operation in U.S. history. And so far, his second term has been marked by an onslaught of anti-immigration rhetoric, attempts to forego due process and abolish birthright citizenship, and deliberate moves to target the most vulnerable Black and brown immigrant populations, despite the immense harm these policies will cause. So how are lawyers and advocates responding? Today we're joined by three guests. Yasmin Taib is a human rights lawyer, progressive strategist, and legislative and political director for Empower Change Action Fund, the largest Muslim digital organization in the U.S., with more than 500,000 members nationwide. Yasmin Taib fled Iran during the Iran-Iraq War and grew up undocumented before becoming a citizen, lawyer, and activist. In 2016, she became the first Muslim woman elected to the Democratic National Committee. She has over 15 years of legislative experience working on Capitol Hill and with organizations like Demand Progress and the Center for Victims of Torture. Hi, Yasmin. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're also joined by Leila Ayoub, an immigration attorney and co-director of Project NR, the Afghan Network for Advocacy and Resources, an Afghan community-based immigration justice organization. They envision a world in which Afghans and all people can move freely without the barriers imposed on them by the system that displaced them to begin with. They recognize that Afghans have faced barriers as a result of decades of foreign policy intervention, and they view individual and collective access to immigration as a form of reparations for their community. Hi, Leila. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Zahra Belu, a civil rights attorney and executive director of the Council on American Islamic Relations, San Francisco Bay Area, the largest Muslim civil rights organization in the country. For over 15 years, Zahra Belu has worked at the intersection of legal advocacy and grassroots organizing, defending communities impacted by surveillance, criminalization, and systemic injustice. Hi, Zahra. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it can't get any more blatant when you think about the Trump administration welcoming 49 white South Africans to the United States and at the same time getting rid of deportation protections for over 9,000 Afghans. And then yesterday, the Supreme Court saying they can also get rid of deportation protections for over 350,000 Venezuelans. Leila, let's start off with you. What are your thoughts about this? I mean, it's all very blatant.
Yes, exactly. So it's definitely nothing new to us to see disparate immigration responses to different communities, and particularly anti-immigrant and xenophobic approaches to Muslim immigrants and other brown and black immigrant communities. And what we saw last week with the termination of temporary protected status for Afghans really shows this. Temporary protected status was only needed because of the lack of policy decisions and the lack of political will to offer permanent protections for our community, despite historical precedent for ensuring a pathway to adjustment and permanent status for other populations that have been part of wartime evacuations. Congress never passed anything similar for Afghans. And so temporary protected status offered a form of protection against deportation and immigration enforcement, which became all the more critical under the new administration's increased immigration enforcement. And that was taken away, and it vulnerable. And it came at the same time as many other sort of chaotic decisions, including all these sudden notices to people who had another form of temporary protection through parole status. And it just leaves people afraid. And so our main goal right now is to help make sure that people have access to information about their rights, and to push back on this clear goal that this administration has to instill fear in our communities, and to make sure that they're empowered and have access to support.
And we will talk about personal stories a little later in the show, because when you really sit back and think about what so many Afghans have gone through when the United States invaded and then the Taliban coming back, and they had no choice but to flee their country if they could get on a flight, and in some cases to think that they had to go to Brazil and then hike through the very dangerous Darien Gap and then try to get to the United States. I mean, you can't even comprehend how difficult this has been for so many people who did not want to leave their country in the first place. So we'll definitely talk about personal stories in a bit. Yasmin, what would you like to add just about how blatant the Trump administration has been with their deportation policies? We'll talk about how things have changed in the second term. But when you think about the visual of them welcoming, chartering a plane for 49 white South Africans to the United States, and then saying, sorry, 9,000 Afghans, 350,000 Venezuelans, you no longer have deportation protections. What are your thoughts just about the message that this sends and the precedent this sets?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, my colleagues and I will agree that, and unfortunately, what we're seeing right now with the Trump administration, the administration is not only advancing kind of this authoritarian agenda through a cruel, inhumane, and unconstitutional crackdown on our rights, but furthering its white supremacist agenda, an agenda and campaign that Trump ran on both times he ran for president. So I wish I could say I was surprised by that announcement, but I think it just, you know, unfortunately is consistent with what we're seeing from this administration in cracking down on the rights of the most vulnerable in our communities. And this is Muslim immigrant, Black and brown immigrant communities. And it's honestly in just unconscionable. We find it incredibly appalling that the administration also, you know, tries to make this distinction in terms of what lives they value more and what, you know, which refugees are permitted to be resettled in the United States and which aren't. I mean, completely decimating the refugee resettlement program during his first administration, also the first day he came into office, right? And even with the travel ban that we're expected to see, my colleagues and I work on that issue very aggressively, and we anticipate dozens and dozens of countries and communities being impacted by, the new travel ban that we're expecting to come out. So it's, I think it just really just feeds into this kind of broader policies that this administration is advancing and, cracking down on our rights, whether it's also in the invocation of the Alien Enemies Act to unlawfully deport immigrants to El Salvador, whether, as Leila noted, the termination of TPS for Afghanistan, Venezuela, the South Sudan visa revocation. We're talking about the termination of status for nearly 5,000 international students, right, since Trump took office, many of whom, thankfully, those statuses were reversed per court orders, and the targeting and abduction of international students advocating for Palestinian rights, right? So essentially, anyone that this administration, that Trump disagrees with, he's going to come after those communities and those individuals and those activists. And we need to do everything we possibly can, as has been noted by Leila, to push back.
Thank you for bringing all of that up, because so much is going on so quickly and it's difficult for people to keep up. Can you give us, do you have any updates on what is happening with South Sudan refugees? The majority of the articles I'm seeing right now are from a month ago.
So I can defer to my colleagues Leila and Zahra. So we actually do not work very closely on the South Sudan visa revocation. Our colleagues from one of our partner organizations, ACT, have been doing a lot of great work on it. But I know that they are working on various kind of tactics and strategies, and working with members of Congress to try to help those communities that are impacted.
Well, thanks for that. The article I can find that is May 2nd. I can't find anything beyond that. But according to a piece in Bloomberg, temporary protections for South Sudanese nationals will automatically be renewed through November 3rd, according to the Department of Homeland Security. But I can't seem to find anything more current. So maybe that's the latest update, but we'll look into it. What about you, Zahra? What would you like to add? I just. To think that on, again, it's this same day that they chartered a plane to bring in 49 white South Africans. They got rid of deportation protections for over 9,000 Afghan refugees. What are your thoughts on this? What message do you think this sends?
It's on brand. It's consistent. Let me thank you for asking the question and for having us. This is consistent with the Trump administration's words. They are doing what they promised they would. It's also consistent with how the Biden administration, for example, made a distinction between how it treated Ukrainian immigrants and Afghan immigrants, right? And who was getting humanitarian parole and at what pace. And so one of the things I remember long admiring about Project Adnar's work, credit to Leila and her team, was actually unearthing how disparate those numbers were. Afghans were applying and not getting responses. Ukrainians were applying and getting responses, right? The money was being spent on both sides, but it was Ukrainians who were moving forward. And so, as concerning as the Trump administration is for the direction it is fast tracking our country in, this is what the United States does. It privileges white immigrants over all others. And that's why this work, this conversation, and all of the efforts to resist our country's racist immigration policies are so needed.
Can you remind us, for people who may have forgotten about this, what happened under the Biden administration? Can you talk specifically about that? How he welcomed Ukrainians to the United States and got a lot of criticism about what happened with Afghans?
Yes, and Layla, like, please jump in and correct me where I get this wrong. I definitely don't want to speak out of my own expertise. My understanding is simply that, like, we had people from both countries fleeing crisis and doing everything they could to come to the United States, and the approval rates for Ukrainians was far higher and faster than for Afghans, despite, you know, compelling stories about Afghans helping our troops and Afghans being loyal to the United States and special immigrant visas being promised. And still, it was the white European immigrants who were coming in much, much faster. Layla and her team at Project Amnar did a lot of work with the Freedom of Information Act to unearth that this wasn't just anecdotal. This wasn't just like our community members saying that they weren't getting the approvals. Actual government documents were showing that there was a difference in how they were treated and a difference in the approval rates for both.
Can you also talk about how temporary protected status actually works? And when the administration decides that they no longer want to implement deportation protections, or in the case of Venezuelans, the Supreme Court says the administration can end temporary protected status, what does that mean on the ground? Yasmin, can you just describe how this process works?
Yeah, and I think I will also defer to Layla on this, since they work on the kind of very specifics on TPS protections for Afghanistan. So for TPS, I mean, there's a very kind of specific process that needs to be followed by the administration. So Layla can kind of speak more about this on how it unfolded with Afghanistan. So there was a lot of kind of chaos around how the TPS termination even was announced for Afghanistan. It was initially supposed to come out in March, because you're supposed to, the administration, DHS in particular, is supposed to provide 60 days notice prior to the status actually terminating. If they don't provide notice through federal regulations, then the status is automatically continued. So Afghans and advocates had not heard anything about the TPS extension or termination for Afghanistan. And then all of a sudden, there was kind of this New York Times article that came out with a quote from the administration saying, oh yeah, we actually terminated TPS for Afghanistan back in, you know, I think it was, what, March 20th, Layla, was the exact date that was 60 days prior to the termination. And then, like, advocates kept looking to see if it was circulated in the regs, and there was no notice formally filed until, like, last week, where then there was this kind of update where the administration said now that TPS termination will be effective July 12th for Afghanistan, which is 60 days from that official notice that was circulated. I mean, that's kind of the process. And then there's, you know, other things that obviously those, you know, 8,000-9,000 that will be impacted by this decision specifically for Afghanistan. There's potentially other avenues that they can pursue, but I'm gonna turn it to Layla, since she works specifically on this.
Yeah, just to add there, this was a clear choice and a message that the administration was sending, because the statute that allows for TPS, it extends the protections for, I believe, 90 days, unless the government makes a decision to actively terminate that. So they chose to end these protections earlier, at the same time that we're seeing them welcoming white South Africans, not only to come to the US, but to come here with refugee status. So they don't have to go through an immigration process that subjects them to potential deportation. They already have that determination, and they have access to permanent protections in the U.S. And this TPS decision, it also I know you all mentioned the facts that were untrue about the situation for South Africans. And what we saw in the TPS decision, the statements from DHS Secretary with that decision were these broad statements about safety in Afghanistan and economic stability. And what we've actually been seeing is that this administration has taken away critical foreign aid to Afghans and others, and the conditions that they're facing, the situation that our community members are afraid of returning to, is a direct result of U.S. foreign policy over decades. And now they're saying, you know, things that are just absurd about the conditions there, and forcing people through harms here, and this fear of being returned to that.
And Layla, now that these deportation protections are no longer in place, what does that mean for Afghans? How does that play out on the ground?
Right. So the reality is that most people have to go through a full immigration process. They have the right to still pursue asylum. Typically, you have to go through that process. It can take months in immigration court before someone gets a deportation order. But it makes them more vulnerable. It results in some people having their work authorization taken away, which leads to so much instability. They can't work. They might not be able to pay for rent. So it just it leaves people more vulnerable. They might have some other form of protection. They might be pursuing their asylum, but that's not an actual legal status. So until they get a decision, they are living in sort of limbo. And what we're seeing is that these are, you know, proactive, affirmative protections that are being taken away. And at the same time, there's policies that are creating delays in processing asylum applications and visa applications. And there's other things being taken away. Has been mentioned, the visas for South Sudan. And, you know, on day one of the Trump administration, there were all these executive orders signed. There was a path laid for the travel ban. And I'll defer to Yasmin and Zahra on this, but, you know, we anticipated an official list of countries would come out, and there was some reporting about a very long list of countries. We haven't seen an official list be, enacted or like visa bans on that list of countries, but we're seeing all of these things being stripped from our communities. It's an effective ban on immigration. It just increases the barriers that our communities face.
We're going to take a quick break. I also want to mention one more aspect of the deportation policies that we're seeing from this administration. The Guardian reports that they deported more than 200 alleged gang members to a notorious prison in El Salvador. This has been getting a lot of attention. And then The Guardian just reported yesterday that at least 50 of the Venezuelan men sent by the administration to this prison in El Salvador entered the United States legally. So there's just so much happening so quickly. And to think that so many people are in this notoriously violent prison because of tattoos cited as evidence, which have no connection to gang activity. The Guardian reports that these markings in many cases reflect personal or cultural references. So there's that happening, and then so many other aspects of what Trump is doing around deportation and administration policies. If you have any questions or comments about what we're seeing in the second term, what changes stand out for you? What questions or comments do you have for our guests? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Again, the same day they welcomed a group of white South Africans to the United States last Monday, they got rid of deportation protections for over 9,000 Afghan refugees who had no choice but to flee Afghanistan. So what are your thoughts on this? Today, we're joined by Yasmeen Tayeb, a human rights lawyer and legislative and political director for Empower Change Action Fund, the largest Muslim digital organization in the U.S. She fled Iran during the Iran-Iraq War and grew up undocumented before becoming a citizen, lawyer, and activist in this country. Leila Ayoub is an immigration attorney and co-director of Project NR, the Afghan Network for Advocacy and Resources, an Afghan community-based immigration justice organization. And Zahra Belu is a civil rights attorney and executive director of the Council on American Islamic Relations, San Francisco Bay Area, the largest Muslim civil rights organization in the country. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, Joan Williams will discuss her new book, Outclassed, How the Left Lost the Working Class and How to Win Them Back. She says the far right manipulates class anger to undercut progressive goals, and liberals often play into their hands. She says if they want to win, they must change class dynamics driving U.S. politics. We hope you can join us for that show tomorrow. If you have a guest idea or a show idea, you can email yourcall at kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation about Trump's deportation and immigration policies the second time around, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall at kalw.org. Today, we're joined by Zahra Belu, civil rights attorney and executive director of the Council on American Islamic Relations, San Francisco Bay Area, Leila Ayoub, an immigration attorney and co-director of Project NR, the Afghan Network for Advocacy and Resources, and Yasmeen Tayeb, a human rights lawyer, progressive strategist, and legislative and political director for Empower Change Action Fund, the largest Muslim digital organization in the U.S. Yasmeen fled Iran during the Iran-Iraq War and grew up undocumented before becoming a citizen, lawyer, and activist. Yasmeen, given your story, I feel like when we talk about these issues, because things are happening so quickly and the numbers are so large, I mean, 9,000 Afghan refugees, 350,000 Venezuelans, the stories often get lost. You have a very personal story. Can you talk about the importance of telling these stories?
Sure. Thank you so much for the question. I think you're absolutely right. I think that the administration in particular believes that, you know, they can kind of move forward with all of these discriminatory, racist, unconscionable policies impacting immigrants and refugees, and that so long as, you know, folks don't know anyone impacted, that it'll just kind of go by and he'll get, you know, it'll be approved or he won't see any sort of pushback in mass from the grassroots and communities. And I think it's so incredibly important, as you noted, for us to get these stories out. And I know this is something that Leila and her colleagues do with Afghans here in the U.S., whether they're on TPS or, you know, parole status. But in specifically with respect to some of the policies of this administration and the way it's been impacting our communities. So for example, during the first during Trump's first time around in the White House, when the various iterations of the Muslim and African bans came out, one of the things we tried to do, and that we had journalists and advocates and members of Congress in particular that kept reaching out to us and telling us, listen, like we need personal stories. We need to be able to talk about how this policy is impacting like our everyday constituents, in my district. And we started doing that. We started doing, more kind of public social media campaigns and highlighting some of these kind of critical stories about how, we had, like, I'm Iranian American, and the majority of those that were impacted by kind of the various iterations of Trump's, travel ban, Muslim ban, were Iranians. And there were so many stories of how, there were times when there were folks that were trying to get their grandmothers to come here because they were sick, and they ended up like getting caught up in the travel ban and their grandmother passed away. Or there were, weddings and graduations that grandparents and parents missed. So it's these kind of very emotional, kind of touching stories, and the way we need to understand how these policies are impacting our neighbors and colleagues and friends is that it's all part of a kind of a broader family separation policy, right? Like when we're talking about whether it's termination of TPS, whether it's these mass deportation policies we're seeing, young people who have literally been here, they were brought here undocumented, like me. I mean, there's the case of the young woman in Georgia, right? That's been all over cable news these last couple of days, where she was picked up by law enforcement because she didn't have a valid license. She came undocumented when she was young. So now she's being put into deportation proceedings, right? It's just like, it's just unbelievable when you think about it. And I was, yes, lucky. So I also came to the States. My mom brought us here through the Mexican border, right, without authorization. So we grew up undocumented, but we were lucky in the sense that we came through what, folks kind of refer to as Reagan's kind of amnesty plan. So we were able to benefit from that, where eventually we got our legal permanent residency. We got these little cards that said illegal alien on them. And then eventually I became a naturalized citizen in college. I was able to go to school, to high school. I got a state scholarship, was able to go to college, then grad school, then law school. And I specifically went to law school to ensure that I would be able to fight and advocate for refugees, right? Those fleeing violence and persecution, the same way where I was afforded these opportunities with my family to be able to stay. And we need to ensure that we do everything we possibly can to show that, our country is welcoming to the most vulnerable, because that's how I benefited from it, so. Mm.
What would you like to add, Layla, about the power of stories? Because we really have to talk about the fact that, at the Republican National Convention, I remember those mass deportation now signs that Republicans and Trump supporters were waving with smiles on their faces. Mass deportation now. And you think about family separation, how much attention that got. And yet 77 million people voted for Trump. They know, that one of the main pieces of his campaign was mass deportation. So what are your thoughts about that? What are your thoughts about the power of storytelling and the fact that so many people, they might not agree with specific aspects of what he's doing, but they voted for mass deportation now, a lot of them.
Right. Yeah, well, we have seen that These kinds of policies, whether it was, you know, the family separation under the previous administration, removing people to third country detention sites, all of these things, they really don't have a lot of public support. And so it's really important for us to keep reminding everyone that this is what the immigration system is set up to do. And there is so much discretion that, you know, a lot of these policies can be legally challenged in courts, but the reality is there is a lot of discretion that allows for so much of what we're seeing. And so we need to push back on all of it, that this immigration system is always separating families. It's always when people are detained, they're taken away from their communities, they're taken to remote detention sites. And we've been seeing that with the targeting of student activists, visa holders, and green card holders. We see that with the policies that brought Afghans here, the pathways that people were brought on these temporary protections. It doesn't allow for people to apply as family units, or it doesn't extend to the extended family, to children over 21. All of these things create an immigration system that separates families. And so, yeah, we have to keep sharing these stories. We have to keep sharing the impact. There's so many people who have already been impacted by these policy changes in just the last few weeks. We're seeing community members who are going to be losing their work authorization, and they don't know what that looks like. And we're working with so many people who their experiences show how those statements about the conditions in Afghanistan are wrong and untrue. The statements that the administration made along with their decision to take away temporary protected status. And yeah, stories are how we push back.
You're talking about Kristi Noem, who's now Homeland Security Secretary, saying that Afghans can go back to their country safely. Is that what you're talking about?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in her statement, she said, Afghans can go back. There's economic stability. The safety situation has changed. And, you know, nobody comes here because they want to leave their home country. Right. Yeah, everything she said was just untrue. And we work with so many people who are afraid of returning home and who cannot really return home. Of course, maybe some people have to, but most people now are afraid of being forced to return. There's so much expert reports that continue to show that the conditions there are not safe, and that massive numbers of people are living in on the brink of famine, and that's a direct consequence of the U.S. government's policy decisions.
You know, you're making me think about what is happening in Afghanistan, and I was just looking this up because I haven't heard much about what's happening there, and just in the, you know, the media that you kind of digest on a daily basis. But the UN had a piece on May 1st that says Taliban restrictions on women's rights intensify. Taliban rulers have followed through on decrees aimed at erasing women from public life in the country and restricting their freedom of movement. There's a new human rights report that's out on this. Beauty salons have been shuttered. There have been forced conversions. Taliban authorities have increased enforcement of repressive restrictions on media outlets, ramped up corporal punishment, clamped down on religious freedom and re-education, and then really cracking down on women's rights. And then, as you said, looking at just the numbers of people living in poverty and people going hungry is just so high. I mean, it's really devastating, Layla, when you think about what has happened, you know, after the United States decided to invade Afghanistan and where we are today.
Yeah, and we see that the government is willing to weaponize those kinds of realities when it serves them to justify military actions and foreign policy decisions. But when people are here and just trying to pursue this legal pathway of asylum, that is their right, the government is denying those realities.
Well, let's hear from a caller who's been waiting patiently. Let's go to Louise in Berkeley. Hi, Louise. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am really curious about what people can do to help keep the, I guess it's over 1,000 people in this country from Afghanistan. I just feel kind of helpless around this issue. And there's got to be something we can do to make it different.
Well, thank you for that. We're getting emails from listeners who also say, what can I do? And it's actually 9,000 Afghans. Is that the right number, Layla?
Yes. Yeah, there's many others who are here as asylum seekers.
So what can people do?
Yeah, and I'd love for my colleagues to add here particularly with regards to ways to engage in policy advocacy and organizing work that's happening. We always really ask folks to support grassroots efforts. My organization exists because we've been filling in gaps that were left by the government, as well as creating space for community members to democratize access to legal services and education for Afghan and other asylum seekers. Across the board, organizations like ours, refugee and immigrant organizations, are facing cuts in funding like fear around supporting our community. So we encourage people to show their support, to both like disseminate the resources that are coming out, as well as give their money and time to community organizations that are supporting immigrants that are subject to these policy changes. But yeah, I'll let others add as well.
Zahra, what would you like to add?
This is a really good time for allies to be in touch with Afghan, Palestinian, and other groups led by the people who are most impacted right now. So that's the first thing, is get to know the organizations in your communities. Just look up like Afghan organization, Palestinian organization, reach out to them, support them. So fund them. When they are organizing protests or actions, be sure that you are there. This is really a time for allies to say, we will be on the front lines with you because we can take risks that maybe you cannot. And I say this, for example, myself as a US citizen. Trump and his administration will try to deport me at some point, but I'm going to be the last on the list. They're going to have to get through a lot of people to get to me. Recognizing that privilege, I need to show up first and foremost and make myself available in that way. And then the third request is that there are a number of resolutions and various attempts at legislation moving through Congress. All of that is really difficult right now because of the Republican majority. But our Democratic elected officials, so, and I'll come back to the Republicans, but our Democratic elected officials need to be pushed to be more courageous. And so look up your member of Congress, see what they have said on this issue, if anything at all. And if they haven't, then push them. Push them to say something, because we are in a moment of crisis and they are expected to hold the line. That is their job, to protect us. And I don't want to write off our Republicans either. I think Republican members of Congress can be pushed and many are movable, but we need to be calling their offices as well. And so whether your member is a Democrat or a Republican, be sure that they have heard from you recently and that they are hearing from you regularly. So three things: get to know the local organizations, support them, including funding them so that they can do the life-saving work that they're doing, show up to actions and events, and then engage your member of Congress.
And what would you like to add, Yasmeen?
I think Zahra covered it. I think as Zahra noted, ensuring that the local communities know that you are there for them, that you're there in solidarity, you're there to support them, and also making sure that, yes, on every issue we work on, whether it's termination of TPS for Afghanistan, whether it's the student abductions and student visa revocations, you know, whether it's the TPS termination for Venezuela, it's incredibly, incredibly important. I know that it's going to get tiring. I know that a lot of folks are going to probably start getting exhausted. But it's incredibly important for members of Congress to hear from their constituents. And I mean, I can just give you a very kind of quick anecdote on the work that we do around the student abductions and the targeting First Amendment rights is, you know, a lot of our members, and we have a very kind of massive grassroots organization, a lot of our members just assume that, okay, well, these cases are being kind of decided in the courts, or, you know, what can I really do? Like, how is me, you know, filling out this email, writing to my member of Congress is actually going to help get Mohsen or Romesa or Mahmoud released, right? And the fact is, a lot of these cases, and you're going to see it with any issue that or any policy that this administration kind of tries to push through, which the vast majority that you're seeing a lot of legal challenges are unconstitutional. He's trying to crack down on our rights, so we're kind of winning in the courts. Is for this reason. So a lot of these issues are not just decided and won in the courthouse, in the courtroom. A lot of these judges look to see these cases are all of kind of public interest. These cases are of political nature. Many of the federal judges in the student abduction cases, including for Dr. Badar Khan Suri, this is the Georgetown scholar that was released last week that we were at his hearing for, you know, this is Romesa Öztürk, Fulbright student, you know, whether it's Mahmoud Khalil, like all of the federal judges in those cases have noted that, you know, they have been supportive and ruled in favor of release of those students and scholars, because otherwise it would have a chilling effect on First Amendment rights. So my point is, a lot of these issues that we're seeing that we feel as though we're kind of, you know, helpless or hopeless, and we feel like we're not going to make an impact, you writing to your member of Congress, telling them to, you know, support your Afghan neighbors, or to speak out and condemn the TPS termination, right, for Afghanistan, or to speak out and condemn the detention and abduction of Romesa or Mahmoud or Mohsen. Like, all of that is incredibly helpful and is also used in the courtroom. So those letters from members of Congress, there's at least 100, right, that spoke out and signed on to a letter led by Representative Jayapal for Mahmoud and the others. All of that is cited by judges in the courtroom. So I'm just kind of reiterating the great comments that Zahra made about ensuring that you're actively engaged, taking action, and specifically making sure that you're writing to and calling your members of Congress on these issues.
And I just wanted to mention one more fact. just based on what the Trump administration is saying about Afghans, Venezuelans, Reuters reports that San Francisco-based U.S. District Judge Edward Chen said the administration's portrayal of the entire Venezuelan TPS population as criminals was, quote, baseless and smacks of racism. The judge said these Venezuelans are more likely to hold bachelor's degrees and less likely to commit crimes than the general U.S. population. And since you were talking about court cases, because so many lawsuits are being filed, Reuters spoke with Ahilan Arulantham, co-director of the UCLA Immigration Law Center and one of the lawyers for the Venezuelan plaintiffs. He told Reuters this is the largest single action stripping any group of non-citizens of immigration status in modern U.S. history, that the U.S. Supreme Court authorized it in a two-paragraph order with no reasoning is truly shocking. So that's just important to cite. Unfortunately, we're out of time. A lot of people are writing in thanking you for your work and wondering what they can do. So we will definitely continue to cover these issues, and we'd love to have you all back. Yasmeen Tayyib is a human rights lawyer, progressive strategist, and legislative and political director for Empower Change Action Fund, the largest Muslim digital organization in the U.S. She fled Iran during the Iran-Iraq War and grew up undocumented before becoming a citizen, lawyer, and activist in this country. Leila Ayoub is immigration attorney and co-director of Project Anar, the Afghan Network for Advocacy and Resources, an Afghan community-based immigration justice organization. And Zahra Bilou is a civil rights attorney and executive director of the Council on American Islamic Relations San Francisco Bay Area, the largest Muslim civil rights organization in the country. Thank you all for your work, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
And thanks to Nina Kissinger for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. And thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.